Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 3:08 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is July 2nd, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I thought we'd kick off with 10-year yields because the yield continues to compress, and it's down again to the lower side of this range that's been forming for the last month. But there's definitely a clear evidence of a downtrend, and certainly a reversion to the mean at the very minimum. And so far it's been pretty modest in terms of the size of the decline, going from about 180 basis points to 140 over the course of about 3 months isn't an awfully big move, but I think we do need to put it into some perspective. I think the first point is that we had a meaningful move higher in 2020. We got up to test that 1.5% level, and now it's back below it, and 1.5% had been the lower side of the overhead trading range, so it's a natural area where we might anticipate some support for prices and resistance for yields coming through, and we certainly have evidence of it right now. And that does beg the question, is this as high as yields are going to go? Are we going to see the price come all the way back down to the 50 basis point level? Or is the yield going to find support soon and hold the region of the moving average, for example, and then rebound and push up and through the 2% and potentially even go back up towards the 3% level? And obviously there are arguments both for and against, because nobody wants to really consider the potential that we're not going to have an inflationary outcome, but rather we're going to have a sharply deflationary outcome, and that prices would go, or the yield would go, all the way back down to 50 basis points. That just doesn't bear thinking about, considering the quantity of money that has been printed and the recoveries that we're seeing in the global economy and the resilience of asset prices in the face of worrying headlines about the spread of different variants in the coronavirus, the potential that that the yield could come all the way back down and approach the nadir of 2020 just is difficult for people to even potentially get their head around. Then let's think about the alternative potential scenario, that the yield goes all the way back up towards 3%. Well, we've had this massive increase in debt, and the cost of servicing that debt and refinancing debt would obviously become a lot more onerous if the yield were to double from current levels. So that would obviously then also represent a clear threat in terms of the outperformance and the ability to continue to outperform of the high technology sector, and most particularly among the companies with no profits at all, and their ability to fund their operations through continued rounds of borrowed money. Well, obviously that would be very much in doubt if the yield were to continue to march higher. So we're at this rather interesting place. It's still a reasonably consistent medium-term uptrend, and there's certainly been some evidence of demand for bonds coming back in and less willingness to accept that there's going to be an inflationary outcome, and also less willingness to accept the potential outcome that the US government, for example, is going to massively increase spending again. I think a good part of the reason why yields surged in the last quarter of 2020 and into the first quarter of this year was not so much about inflationary pressures, but rather it was simply about supply and demand. That there was going to be a massive excess of additional bonds that would need to be sold, and investors were demanding a better return than was currently on offer. So yields rose in response to that. So certainly when we think about inflationary pressures There was a lot of worry about the lumber price back in May, and since then it has fallen by nearly $1,000. So anyone who was worried about construction materials and the fact that we were looking at builders curtailing their plans for new homes and demanding that people who'd put down deposits would have to ante up an additional deposit because of the rising cost of production. Well, that's much less of a factor today, at least in terms of construction materials. But of course, construction wages continue to rise. But one thing that we can think about here is that the home builders, they rallied spectacularly on the back of that surge in lumber prices. But there's no real particular reason why that should be the case, other than that it was reflective of demand for new homes. But these kinds of companies make significantly higher margins when construction materials go down and less pressure to reduce prices comes through. So the reduction in lumber prices is probably good news for the consumers of lumber, and certainly home builders are those consumers. So we get the step up in the price, but not the continued step up in price. So that helps to mitigate some of the inflationary pressures overall. We've definitely also seen that gasoline prices are rising, but that's pretty normal for this time of the year. We're entering the driving portion of the year where people like to go off on vacation. So gasoline prices are now breaking out to new recovery highs, and we haven't seen highs like this since about 2014. And a good part of the reason for that is because people have been cooped up for the most of the last year and they want to go on vacation, so they're getting in their cars and they're driving somewhere else. So we normally get a bump in terms of gasoline prices in the summer, and certainly as we approach the Independence Day holiday in the USA, well, a lot of people will be out and driving. But we should be asking, is there really a deficit of oil? Is there a shortage of gasoline? We've certainly seen that propane prices have risen significantly. They rose first because of the demand for outdoor heating during the winter because of social distancing, and then they are rising now because of increasing demand during the normal part of the year, and it holds out the prospect that there will be f less in the way of inventories as we approach next year's winter season. So there are some of these supply disruptions have a bit of a long tail, but they're not permanent in nature. So the bond market seems to be reasonably sanguine because they are, or at least they are willing to accept that the Federal Reserve's contention that inflation is going to be transitory might in fact turn out to be the case, at least when it comes to commodity prices, or at least some commodity prices. When I think about companies, and I have been sort of searching around for companies that might reflect this theme, I've been looking at Trex. Well, they produce plastic decking for the outdoors. So one of the things that anyone who's ever bought decking, and wooden decking in particular, knows is that you have to do upkeep, and you have to look after it, and you have to paint it, and you have to clean it, you have to treat it against rot. And then if you buy plastic decking, well, it doesn't have the look, or I guess it doesn't have the feel of real timber, but it doesn't require nearly as much upkeep. So the share has been doing rather well over the course of the last decade, and then it really accelerated during 2020. There was a lot of demand for outdoor equipment. But one of the most attractive characteristics of that outdoor equipment is its permanence. And the innovation that we're seeing in the materials sector in terms of polymers, I think, is particularly interesting, because we can think about the Formula One cars, and they're made from carbon fiber, and that carbon fiber has always been considered to be extraordinarily expensive, so it wasn't ever really viable in terms of automotive bodies. And of course, we've seen carbon fiber coming through in the aeronautics sector. So, in niche sectors where cost is less of an issue and where there is clear demand for high efficiency and low weight, and or at least high and then strong materials with low weights, then it tends to find a home. What we're also, though, seeing is that polymers have advanced to a stage. If we think about the stresses that a normal ammunition round experience as it goes through the barrel of a gun. I mean, there is an explosive charge behind it, and then it has to explode outward, and then there is a great deal of heat that is created, and massive stresses that are contained in a small area. And historically, that has been the I guess the preserve of copper and brass. And today, you can get ammunition casings that are made of polymers. So they are capable of sustaining high heat and integrity and under great pressure for limited periods of time, and then they're similarly priced to the available ones as well. Then we also now see that there are cellulose shotgun casings. So they're obviously attractive to people who are worried about polluting the environment. And a large number of hunters are very concerned about the welfare of the wetlands, for example, that are the hunting grounds that they are active in. And they're also worried about the environment just like everybody else. So this invention of cellulose shotgun casings is obviously a significant innovation, but it's also reflective of innovation and technology that has wider use cases. So there are plenty of single-use items that could be used, or that's where cellulose could be used instead of plastics. And then there are plenty of long-use items where which we have previously relied on timber and steel and cement, where polymers could be redeployed. So these are, I think, rather significant developments, and particularly when we think about oil, because everything else looks like we have a commodity-led bull market. We have copper prices that are breaking on the upside. We have industrial resources prices that are breaking out. We have agricultural prices that are approaching all-time highs. There are droughts, floods, worries about the climate, more active hurricanes, and supply disruptions in terms of just about all forms of commodities. Difficulties in terms of regulation and taxation, and these are affecting just about all forms of commodities. So it's likely that we're in a new secular bull market environment, and then, of course, on top of all of those additional concerns, we have governments that are falling over themselves trying to come up with infrastructure projects because they're worried about social disruption, they're worried about high unemployment, and they're desperate to get people back to work and off the streets. And the classic solution to those kinds of problems is infrastructure development. So we have both push and pull here. But when we think about commodity-led bull markets, then the 1970s is obviously a big example, and then the early 2000s is another big example. And both of those occasions were predicated on oil prices rising, because oil is a very significant input cost for just about everything. And the cost of energy, or energy generally in most mining, is up in the region of about 25% of costs. When we think about the production of agricultural products, it's probably somewhere around 10 to 15%, depending on the agricultural product. If we incorporate not just the cost of transportation and driving tractors around, but also the cost of nitrogen fertilizers, which rely on natural gas. So, if we're going to have a commodity-led bull market, then we absolutely have to have an answer for, is oil going to lead the way or participate in that commodity-led bull market? And it's hard to make that argument. So certainly the innovation that we're seeing in the materials sector, where there is significant potential competition that will be encouraged because of rising costs in other areas. One thing we know about commodity-led bull markets is that the cure for high prices is high prices. And high price of lumber will encourage a substitution. Particularly when we think about a house where the internal portions of the house you never really see. So why do they have to be made of timber? Could they not be made of something else? When we think about basements, they could generally be built of concrete blocks, but there are polymers today that are going to last longer and are easier to put up in less time and cheaper. So why not simply just use those instead? Those sorts of innovations in key sectors with large sources of potential demand, well, those are the kinds of substitution arguments that could certainly start to occur and increase demand for the plastics and generally the refined products portion of the oil market, which would boost demand. But at the same time, we also have this knock-on effect that the automotive sector is not investing in any new technology for internal combustion engines. And palladium is the perfect example of that. The price of palladium is at $2,786, and it continues to march higher, and it rebounded again in here this week. So it's still trending higher. It's still got this clear sequence of higher reaction lows, and it has reliably bounced from the region of the trend mean on successive occasions. And there's a good reason for that. It's because normally, when you had prices up around this level, there would have been substitution already for platinum. And platinum is capable of being a catalyst for petrol cars, and it's the preferred catalyst for diesel engines. But the reality is that there is nobody willing to do the retooling because there's no investment going into internal combustion engines. So they're just simply going to play it out because they don't anticipate using more palladium, and they're not going to do the retooling because they anticipate making more batteries. So when we think about companies like Johnson Matthey, they do well because they're playing both sides of that argument. And they're selling both of those commodities. But the share is not breaking out. It's been going sideways for the last 13 years. And there's no uptrend here. It's a clear range. So they're netting one off against the other, but they're not really firing on all cylinders. So then let's just go back and think about oil prices. Well, transportation is a massive source of demand for oil. And it's going to be a declining source of demand, or at least the growth rate in demand is going to moderate significantly in the next few years. The electric vehicle market continues to grow, and certainly they are becoming more attractive for the occasional commuter, and most particularly as people like working from home. Well, when you work from home, you don't drive as much as you would when you're commuting from a suburban neighborhood. You do end up driving somewhat, but I know, for example, I've been working from home for the last golly, what time, what is it now? It's 2021. I started working from home around 2007. So it's been 14 years. And we don't need a second car, although we are certainly talking about buying one now. And we only drive about 7,000 miles a year. And we were living in Los Angeles, and that is a very car-heavy city. But when you work from home, you don't have to commute. Well, if a lot of people work from home, they'll drive fewer miles. And that's certainly going to be true of a percentage of people. I still think, though, that a lot of people are going to find themselves back in the office. The reality today is that we have a greater appreciation for just how social we all are and how much we depend on social interaction, fellow feeling with people around us. And I think that that is going to encourage people to go back to the office. Now, it might not be on every day, and there will certainly be demand for more flexible schedules and most particularly to look after children and other priorities. And having some freedom to also look after elderly relatives is going to be something that will also encourage people into the workforce if that's available to them. We also have to, I think, pay attention to the fact that a large segment of people have retired over the course of the last year. And as the baby boomers age, they're going to need more people to look after them. So flexible work schedules will certainly help in that. It means there'll be less demand for miles traveled on one side of the economy, but then with electric vehicles, then there won't be any demand for oil at all. So on the one hand, there's going to be less demand, and then you also have the added question of carbon credits. And this is a trend that just keeps giving. And the carbon credit market pushed on to a new high in here this week. And the reason it's doing it is because it is politically motivated. The politicians want them higher. There are European officials who want this price at 100, and there's nothing to stop them from getting it up there. They want Europe to be energy independent. This is not just about global warming. It's about a geopolitical imperative. Nobody was really worried about energy independence when nobody was energy independent. And that was the status quo. Well, today you have a condition where the largest consumer has turned into one of the largest exporters of energy. That has completely upset the status quo. So now Europe is looking to become energy independent by pioneering the taxation of carbon and then pioneering the development of renewable energy. And it's not a mistake that some of the largest companies that are in the wind sector are European, and that there are plenty of solar companies are also European. But solar is very much dominated by Chinese companies because they went for scale and they provided any assistance that was necessary in order to achieve market dominance, and they succeeded. And then we can also think about the fact that the Chinese have also invested heavily in battery technology, and they continue to invest in this sector. They want to become dominant in it, so they are trying to lock down supplies of the key resources. They already have the processing and refining dominance in just about all of the industrial resources, and they continue to do well in terms of selling batteries as well. Well, that would suggest to me at least that oil prices are not going to trend higher in a secular manner. We're certainly seeing that prices have been steady and they're coming up towards this $80 area. But the only reason that prices have been able to rally in such a profound manner is because OPEC is holding 8 million barrels a day off the market. And that's almost equivalent to all of Saudi Arabia. So when we think about what that means, it's simple that OPEC is attempting to have a price setting mechanism. And We also know that the vast majority of shale is economic around the $45 to $50 area, and you could hedge out production to 2029 at about $59. So the shale sector is profitable at this level, and it's likely to remain profitable at these levels. And from a political perspective, prices that are reasonable for the shale sector and reasonable for the consumer are to be ex will be a happy medium. So politically, it's going to be a kind of a happy medium to have prices somewhere between $70 and $80. And that's probably also a happy medium for most of OPEC. Obviously, there are countries like Venezuela where they need prices probably in excess of $200 to meet their obligations, and they're just not going to get that. But as long as OPEC and Russia agree on curtailing supply, then we're going to have a reasonably benign environment. But we would need geopolitical stresses that are medium term in nature to send prices north of $100. So now the question is, will we have a commodity-led bull market without oil? And the reality is that this commodity-led bull market will probably be about copper, because copper prices are right in the region of their all-time peaks, and it's where the big new use case is coming through. In order to achieve the battery technologies that will have cars going for 600 miles and have wind turbines spinning out, and then also for the evolution of electric vehicles, we're going to need a lot more copper. As we think about the electrification of the economy, we're going to need a lot more generating capacity. We're going to need a lot more transportation in terms of wiring and the conveyance of electricity across vast swathes of countryside. So there's going to be a lot of demand for copper, and it takes an awfully long time to develop those kinds of resources. So China has said that they're going to sell out of their state stockpiles, and the market certainly pulled back in a pretty violent manner in response to that. But it never looked likely that that was going to be a longer term eventuality, because China has now confirmed that they're going to sell down about 1% of their state stockpile. And that's a trivial number. It was never really, I think, realistic that they were going to sell very much of it, because the reason that China built up that stockpile, it wasn't for their it wasn't for fun, but they built up a stockpile to insulate the economy from the potential that geopolitical conflict would curtail imports of copper. So there's just no way that they're going to sell down that stockpile. Well, if that's the case, then copper prices have just are just consolidating in the region of the upper side of this range that's been forming for 14 years. And there's ample scope for additional upside, and it's doing well because of low oil prices. But it would do even better if oil prices were higher, because there is a clear determination by Europe to try and compete and to preserve its relative position compared to the USA by trying to become energy independent. And the only way they can do that is really through copper rather than oil. So they're substituting reliance on one commodity relative to another, but at least copper is recyclable, and once oil is burned, it's gone. So I think that might be part of their rationale. Then, of course, we have China. So China is has already become the leader in solar. They're now also the leader in batteries, and they also want to become energy independent. Of course, the one problem with relying on intermittent sources of energy is that when it becomes dominant on the grid, then you run into trouble when it's intermittent. That's certainly something we've seen with California, with the increasing footprint of solar on their grid, then they get these massive spikes during the day. And it tends to upset the base load requirements. So the viability of maintaining gas and coal fired power plants, well, it's costly because of the carbon credits that they have to pay, and it pushes up the price overall because you have to maintain all of this redundant supply. So they need to come up with a new form of base load electricity. Well, the new form is kind of the old form. It certainly suggests that there is a place for uranium. And the uranium ETF continues to trend higher. So it's doubled over the course of the last 6 or 7 months, and it continues to hold a sequence of higher reaction lows. Well, there's lots of new plans for uranium, and we're thinking about fourth generation reactors, molten salt reactors, modular reactors, small reactors, and then of course there is the promise of fusion reactors. And I continue to think that the most important thing is the speed of innovation. People have had these estimates of when we'd have fusion energy. They've always been around 25 years, and now they're thinking more like 5 years. And the probable worst case scenario is that we'll have net positive energy from the reactor being built in the south of France at some point in the early 2030s, so that's less than a decade away. Well, if that's the case, then there's the potential that there's going to be a massive energy revolution, one way or the other, within the next 15 years. So there's a lot of angling around about what that's going to entail, and there's a good reason for why that has to happen, is because we look at our energy infrastructure, and we look at the roads, and we look at the nuclear power plants that were built in the 1950s and 60s, and they're all reaching the end of their useful lives. We're looking at the dams that were built all maybe 100 years ago, or 80 or 60 years ago, and water is becoming a stressed resource, and then, because the water resources are stressed, they're becoming less reliable sources of energy. It means that one way or the other, there is going to have to be significant additional infrastructure building, which means that it's a competitive market for ideas. So Australia is pioneering green hydrogen, and they are niggling about the planning process. So the Asian Renewable Energy project, where they wanted to build 14 gigawatts, was held up because it was going to endanger wetlands. Fortescue Metals wants to go ahead and build a similar sized project, and they'll probably have to go through regulatory hurdles as well. Over the last week, Kazakhstan has decided that they're going to go ahead and build a 45 gigawatt hybrid solar and wind project to deliver 3,000, it's some ridiculously large number of tons of green hydrogen per annum. So there's a lot of money flowing into this sector because, in many respects, hydrogen is energy storage. You're taking renewable energy and you're putting it into a resource that can be burned anytime you want. So we are also now at the cusp of a hydrogen fuel sector, or a hydrogen fuel cycle, and these are, I think, significant innovations. It's also likely to contribute to less demand for oil. So there's a massive transition going on, and that's also a clear reason why Saudi Aramco bought the Saudi Arabian big chemicals company before it IPO'd. And sorry, not sure why that didn't come up. And let me find the. Why can't I get that up? Just going to pull up the Saudi Arabian index, and we can clearly see that it is surging higher. So Saudi Arabia is certainly doing well from higher prices overall, and they have a company that is doing well because not only is it producing the oil, but it's also controlling the refining of products. So Saudi Aramco is not leading the market higher, but it's concentrating on paying out dividends. But the chances are that it will be a leader in the production of polymers and plastics that will power through and start to really compete with other forms of materials. So that, I think, is also a potentially geopolitical angle to this commodity-led bull market. China has got massive production of steel and huge industrial capacity. So we can think then about their geopolitical imperative. Xi Jinping has clearly stated that they're not going to tolerate global interference in the Taiwan question. And there have been a number of articles about how the opening up of China was negotiated, and the only thing they've been interested in for the last 40 years is Taiwan. And Xi Jinping has become leader for life because he said he would solve the Taiwan question. And now that the 100-year celebrations for the Communist Party are over, the price was down, the CSI 300 was down 2% in here today. It was the worst performing market in the world. And this is on a day when the majority of markets were on the up. I think that when we think about geopolitical imperatives, China wants to become the global hegemon. And they have been setting plans in motion for most of the last 30 years to achieve those goals, and they are becoming progressively more self-assured that victory is within their grasp. So the rest of the world is waking up to that intention right now. And it does suggest that there is going to be a cause for conflict, and it's really then only a question of what would be the catalyst. So, certainly there's the potential that Taiwan could be the catalyst, and everyone's paying attention to that. And then there's also the fact that India has moved 200,000 troops to the border with China. So, it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that the Tibetan independence movement might start to gain some attraction or some attention in the media. And if for only the only reason would be to upset Chinese sensibilities. But we are looking at a more difficult geopolitical environment, and there are a lot of different things that are taking place in terms of this competition between China and the rest of the world. When we think about the dollar index, well, historically, at these, it looks like this is a completing top formation. And there's been a lot of enthusiasm to say that this has been a big bottom for the dollar and that it is going to rally significantly over the course of the next few years. Just today, I saw an article from a technical analyst with an extraordinarily long history saying that gold would trend downwards until 2024 and that the dollar was primed to rally for at least another 3 years. So we're certainly getting a market in ideas, and people are starting to come out really bullish for the dollar. Wasn't quite able to hold all of its advance in here today. Well, the one thing that I think is important is, of course, that all currencies are ratios. So, in order to have a big bull market or a bear market in a currency, you have to have a big bull market or bear market in another currency. And the reason that the dollar index trended downwards from 2002 until 2008 was because of multilateral intervention to support the euro. And after launching the euro, it declined pretty meaningfully. So the major central banks bent it up and tried to support it. And they succeeded, and the dollar index trended lower for the next 6 years. And it was helped along by the Federal Reserve holding interest rates down in the aftermath of the busting of the TMT boom and 9/11. So there were a number of different factors that contributed to that. Then we had the dollar starting to trend higher from 2011, where we had the Tea Party coming into focus, and we had the government actually talking and acting to curtail government spending. So that helped to support the dollar. The relative strength of the economy coming out of the credit crisis, that all contributed to strength in the dollar and the interest rate differential, particularly against a background where Europe in particular experienced a great deal of stress in response to the sovereign wealth crisis. So that contributed to a big bull market in the dollar index. So we're now in this range, and this range has been forming for the last 5 years, and we're at the lower side of the range, and the price is right in the region of the trend mean. So the big question is, who's going to print more money? Is it going to be the USA? Are they going to hold interest rates lower and continue to print? Or will Europe print more? Will Europe continue to print and to issue pan-European bonds? Will they abandon the fiscal constraints that were really self-imposed over the course of the last decade and go for growth? I think it's quite likely that as we see politics changing in Europe and the Green Movement becoming more powerful and potentially setting up to at least share power in Germany after the election that's coming up, there is the potential at least that Europe will spend more money and that they will try and achieve their geopolitical imperative of creating energy independence. And that is not going to be cheap. And they've also got restive populations who've been voting in populist governments. And that is basically a revolution against fiscal consolidation. And if they want to hold the European project together, well, they're going to need to print that money. So there's going to be a competitive devaluation. And at least, to me at least, this looks like a top. It looks like we have higher lows, excuse me, we have lower highs. We had a peak in 1985, a peak in 2001 and 2, and then another peak in 2020. And there's the clear scope that the dollar will trend lower overall. But the question is, when will that occur? Are we going to see it soon, or are we going to see an additional rally? Well, the dollar index put in a downside Q reversal in here today. And the euro is beginning to steady from the lower side of its range. And the yen has, I think, probably got greater potential to trend lower, but it is looking a little tired, or the dollar is looking a little tired in the short term. So there's the scope here that the dollar is going to weaken a little further. And then when we start thinking about the outlook for stocks, well, gold continues to firm, and it's been up for 3 consecutive days now. Unfortunately, there isn't any evidence of clear upward dynamics. If we had a dynamic similar to what we had in March, that might lend some credence to the view that we've got a higher reaction low. It's certainly trying to put in a higher reaction low, but if it can push back above $1,800 and hold it, that would be a lot more convincing. What is convincing is that silver is steadying from the region of the trend mean, and it continues to exhibit relative strength overall. Well, one thing that we've seen over the years is that gold and silver, well, I guess silver generally tends to outperform gold. And I'm really trying to find, there we go, the gold-silver ratio. When we think about how these things evolve over time, gold generally leads at the beginning of the bull market because people are not convinced and they concentrate on the big hard asset. So gold tends to do best at the beginning, and subsequently silver then starts to pick up pace. So silver outperforms in the second and third stages of the bull market. We can go back and think about the early 2000s. So this trend is of gold rising. So gold was 120 times the price of silver in 2020, and now it's down to 67 times. So gold outperformed all the way up to about 2003, and then from 2003 until just about 2007, silver outperformed. And then gold outperformed during the worst of the crisis, and then silver went on a tear and really outperformed through to the end of that bull market. And then it underperformed gold all the way through the bear market. And when we think about the fact that gold started to really bottom around 2016, and then it started breaking out in 2019, silver hasn't really started to outperform until the middle of 2020, and it's likely to outperform all the way through the rest of this bull market. So it's still exhibiting relative strength, and this continues to look like an evolving bull market overall. I remain very much of the view that by the time this bull market is over, two things will have happened. The first is that gold will be trading out to new all-time highs in purchasing power parity. Would represent a significant advance from where we are right now. And this really doesn't look like much more than a consolidation in the region of the all-time peak. And then we can also think about this, that ETF holdings of gold are now the third or fourth largest holdings in the world. So ETF holdings now hold more gold than the vast majority of central banks, and probably not quite more yet than Germany, China, and the USA, but more than just about everyone else. By the time this bull market ends, ETFs will probably hold more gold than all central banks combined. But at the moment, at least, we are still on a downward swing in terms of ETF ownership. And until that turns around, well, then it's likely that gold prices will struggle for a little while longer. But as long as silver continues to hold the region of the trend mean, then I remain reasonably sanguine about gold. And if we do get an additional decline from where we are right now, I will buy more. In the meantime, I'm waiting for a higher, I think, clear evidence of a higher reaction low before I buy more gold shares. But I do think that we are close to a low. So I think it's probably one of the sectors that's worth watching because it's one of the few that has in fact reverted back to the mean and more and is looking reasonably cheap. So we've seen seriously impressive performance from technology shares. They're continuing to benefit from the compression in yields and the reversal in the expansion of the yield curve spread. I was worried about technology and the high growth sector in the first quarter of this year because bond yields were rising. But this continues to look like an impressive trend on the upside because yield curve spread, or the yield curve spread, I should say, has begun to reverse. So it really is an awfully big question because historically, after every recession, this ratio has got right back up to around the 300 basis point level. And on this occasion, it got to about 160 basis points. So, also after the inversion, well, the inversion itself is the lead indicator, and then the pushing up out of the inversion is usually reflective of central banks panicking and cutting interest rates aggressively so that they get this very wide spread between the long and the short ends of the curve. So, if that had occurred on this occasion, and we had seen the long end of the curve start to rise significantly because the short end of the curve couldn't really fall any further, well, that would have contributed to a massive headwind for growth and non-profitable companies. But we didn't get that, and the bond yield has stopped rising, and it is now contracting. And if this is the peak and it continues to march lower over time, and inflationary pressures are kept in check. So, this is, I think, the big question. And it really is about the outlook for bonds. Because bonds are the big bull market. And everything is priced off the 10-year. And but it's most particularly true of the high growth sector and the private equity sector. It's those types of companies where they have a reliance on access to liquidity and they then deploy that liquidity in higher returning assets. And that ability to double down and double down and double down on that kind of business strategy has transformed the fortunes of endowments. And it has transformed the fortunes of companies that follow that kind of business model or some form of it, where they invest the proceeds from one business into the R&D and developing niche products from other completely different businesses. So, Danaher would be one example of that. And then you think about Brookfield Asset Management, then they bought up the assets of SunPower out of bankruptcy and created Brookfield Renewable Partners. So that's an ex additional example. The fact that Amazon was an online retailer and then devoted significant resources to its Amazon Web Services cloud supporting business. The fact that, that Google is basically an advertising company and is devoting massive resources to the development of autonomous vehicles and quantum computers. So that's all predicated on access to additional cheap liquidity. And when bond yields come down, then those companies really do very well. So we're definitely seeing that the big companies are starting to push back up again. So they are responding to this compression in government bond yields, and Apple is now at a new closing high. Amazon is right in the region of the upper side of its range as well. Microsoft has been pushing on the upside. Google has been clearly outperforming. So they're leading the way higher for the Nasdaq, and they are the clear beneficiaries from this compression in government bond yields. So then it comes down to wages. So the kinds of inflationary pressures that we've seen in the market over the course of the last 6 months are all commodity related, and none of them are particularly pressing. So obviously, copper is in a new bull market. But lumber, there's no shortage of trees. Oil, there's no shortage of oil. And the list goes on. There's a shortage of chips. And that's putting upward pressure on prices, and it's creating demand for used vehicles, etc. But chips are cyclical, and any investment in additional new supply will certainly contribute to higher prices in the short term and then lower prices later. And nothing has occurred to question the conclusion that the chip sector is cyclical. It's really the question of wages. Well, wage demand growth came in at exactly what it was predicted at in here today. And the big question is, are we in a period of time where we're going to see universal basic income? Because if we do, then the dollar is going to trend downwards, and there's very little to question that hypothesis. And the big unanswered question is, when you look at what's been happening with the USA and the massive amount of money that's been created, and the conclusion from just ordinary people that they were due a bailout, and that in future, any other crisis that occurs, they should also be bailed out, and that it is just too much to ask for people to go back and work for the same low wages that they were having before when they were making more from doing nothing. So those are significant challenges. The end of the moratorium on evictions and the expiry of those outsized benefits, well, all of that is going to contribute to demands for higher spending. And the potential is that we're going to have deficits continue to spiral higher. So global deficits are around 1.8 trillion right now. And that's down from the almost 2.5 trillion that it was back in April, but it's still $1.8 trillion of deficits on a global basis. So this is not going away. And we're looking at the reality of universal basic income. And as long as the money is flowing, we'll have bull markets. It's when interest rates start to back up, it's when wages and expectations for higher prices start to take effect. That's when the yield will start to move. And it's when higher yields really start to get delivered. That's when a lot of the challenges that we just got a foretaste of in the first quarter of this year will start to come into effect. The one thing that I think is very reflective of the amount of liquidity that's been created in the last year is the cryptocurrency markets. They tend to be lightning rods for speculation because of the potential for massive gains. Nobody likes to think about the massive falls, but they're equally liable to fall, and Bitcoin has a history of declining by between 80 and 90% following surges on the upside. When it had a market cap of $1 trillion and people were predicting that within the next year it would be at 10 trillion, they never really asked where all the money was going to come from. So in order to have a big bull market in cryptocurrencies, you need massive money at printing. And it's reasonable to estimate that about 10% of all the money printed in 2020 went into cryptocurrencies. So in order to get to the 500,000 big round number target that people were predicting, we'd probably need to see $100 trillion printed. And in order for that to happen, we would need to have a crisis larger than the pandemic. And the only thing that I can think of is World War III. So that's not exactly a benign scenario, but it does not look likely in the short term. And in order to get even back up to the $65,000 level, well, then there would have to be very significant additional new money printing. And again, that's not immediately apparent where the acceleration necessary in the money supply it will be to get there. It's not like money supply isn't rising quickly, but The challenge is that it's not rising quickly enough to justify the aspirations of the cryptocurrency sector. And historically, we can just simply think about the fact that Bitcoin tends to find support around the 1,000-day moving average, and we are nowhere near that right now. And then there's the additional point that it really tends to do well from about a year ahead of the halvening. And the next halvening won't be until 2024. So the really interesting time to be interested in Bitcoin will probably be somewhere around the middle of 2023. And in between now and then, it's probably going to be a progressively less exciting place to be. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.